Today, we bring together two best friends from childhood who were once inseparable, but then lost touch as they embarked on very different political journeys. Peter Mandelson, an architect of New Labour under Tony Blair, and Steve Howell, who has worked as a close aide to Jeremy Corbyn, including as Deputy Director of Strategy in 2017. And the emergence of climate anxiety. This is the story of two Labour parties, of Blairism.
The challenge we face is not in our values, it is how we put them into practice.
And Corbynism.
The elite extract wealth from the pockets of ordinary working people any longer. Our offer.
A story told by key figures on opposite sides of the divide. Peter Mandelson, who drove Labour towards the centre ground as an architect of Tony Blair's New Labour. And Steve Howell, who became a senior strategist at the heart of Jeremy Corbyn's 2017 election campaign. But if we rewind 60 years, these two men were inseparable school friends, sharing the same radical politics. How and why their ideologies diverged gets to the heart of some of the big questions facing the Labour Party as it looks to elect a new leader. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does a divided friendship tell us about Labour's future? Steve, take us back to Hendon in the 1960s. What was it like? What were you like?
Hendon was a relatively affluent middle-class suburb. Hendon County, the school we were at, was a grammar school, and it had delusions of grandeur. The prefects used to walk around in gowns, and I think the head teacher thought he was running a public school.
His name was Potts.
Yes.
E.W.
Maynard Potts.
What were your first impressions of each other?
He was very funny.
Was Peter
was
funny?
Fun.
Yes, he was witty as well, in a sort of dry, slightly sarcastic way.
Who would ever have thought that?
And I think you wrote, Peter, that Steve used to tease you about being a political anorak.
Yes, he did a bit. He just had a broader life than me, and I was just pretty political.
What, age 11?
I remember bringing a geography lesson to a halt as I argued with the headmaster over the then Labour government's white paper on In Place of Strife.
And on what?
It was reforming trade unions.
You were Labour in your heart then?
It was Labour in my DNA. I am biologically tied to the Labour Party.
And it sounds like you were great mates.
You know, we never stopped talking, really, about everything. And then his parents used to go away at the weekend.
Parties every weekend.
Parties every weekend.
Actually, I fear that what you were doing was sitting around reading political scripts while the rest of us
the parties
would be like
were
breaking
okay.
out the booze.
The parties were okay.
We were producing the, you know, monthly magazine of the Labour Party Young Socialists. It is true.
But not on a Saturday night.
But the much bigger issue was that we and others organised against our own school to turn it into a comprehensive. And this drove the headmaster, Potts, who called us industrial militants who were tearing apart the fabric of the school community, absolutely mad. He literally walked out of the school.
Mm. And so you take this revolutionary zeal and you leave the Labour Party. What happened?
Oh, we went on an excursion into the Young Communist League. Mm. It was all Steve's idea. I had nothing to do with it. It was
everything in our programme has been costed.
I remember one thing that put us out of the Labour Party, and that was Vietnam.
Government expenditure programme for the next 5 years.
What about Vietnam?
Michael knows we have no plans for expenditure in Vietnam.
It wasn't that the Labour government were putting troops in, but we felt they didn't condemn American bombing. And that did activate us quite a lot. It was disillusioning.
So we went along to one of the meetings to see what it was like, and we decided to stick with it.
What was it like? Can you remember?
I don't know. All I remember was on Friday evening standing outside Kilburn tube station selling copies of the Morning Star.
Yes.
It was
When she got a photograph of that.
When I say selling, I mean, there weren't very many buyers and it was always rather cold.
Mm. It sounds like you were quite a lefty.
Peter was a full-blown socialist and considered himself to be a Marxist at the time.
Did I?
Yes. What went wrong, Peter?
I discovered that Marxism doesn't change the world and it doesn't improve the lot of people in our country.
Let's come to that, because after this kind of lovely-sounding childhood in Hendon, where you were really inseparable, you both went off onto your gap years. Steve, you went to the US. Peter, you went to Tanzania. Friendly as you were, you exchanged letters. And lucky for you, Steve, Peter's lost yours. But Peter, Steve has your letters, and they are lovely, typed on the blue paper of airmail. And look, there's loads of interesting things in here. But you were also having doubts about that shift from the left. I don't know if you'd be prepared to read them. Have a look.
The highlighted in yellow?
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel that I'm positively changing in my philosophy of life. Other times I feel that I'm retaining the force and commitment of my YCL-bred attitudes and beliefs, but I'm just not having the opportunity to expound them or act on them. And other times I feel that my revolutionary ardour is fading because I'm a bourgeois at heart. God, the guilt. And that the life I enjoy most does not exactly revolve around the class struggle. God. When did I write that? What year? 1973.
And here you go, one tiny more bit.
It's troubled me, especially because at times I have felt that I am losing a socialist grip on myself. God, how serious. Sometimes I reason that Tanzanian socialism is tremendous and is the only hope for development, but that socialism in England would be wholly impracticable and that we are living in an ideological cloud cuckoo land in which England no more has a socialist future than fly in the air. Heavens.
How do you feel reading that?
I do remember it was a lot of turmoil during this time.
Internal
turmoil about what I believed, how I should express my politics. The question was the parliamentary road or the alternative. I mean, do you take to the streets or do you pursue power? And that was the struggle that was going on inside me at that time.
I don't think the two are mutually exclusive.
And at this time, Steve, you're in America. You receive these type letters from your best friend. How did you feel?
I suppose I felt that he was backtracking really on the politics that we shared, and therefore I was frustrated by them, I think, would be one of my feelings.
Following their gap years, Steve goes to university in Sheffield, while Peter heads to Oxford. They stay in touch.
For many Britons, these are hard times.
But as Britain experiences the winter of discontent...
In the last 2 years, Britain has suffered one of the highest inflation rates in Europe.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
And Margaret Thatcher wins her landslide. Their politics begin to drift apart.
And where there is despair, may we bring hope.
If I take you into the 80s, Steve, you were still in Sheffield. You hadn't rejoined the Labour Party. Why not?
Well, in Sheffield, the atmosphere that you had in other parts of the country, because it's such a working class city, the trade union movement was very strong. A lot of the most influential people in the trade union movement were communists, and they worked very closely with people who were in the Labour Party. So when I got to Sheffield, somebody who took me under his wing was George Caborn, who was probably the most best-known trade unionist in the city. He was a communist, and his son, Richard, was the main mover and shaker in the Labour Party. So there wasn't any impediment to being active in the movement because you were a communist. And in fact, David Blunkett appointed me to a job in 1982 organising a UN conference that Sheffield was hosting on apartheid.
In this period, Michael Foot became leader of the Labour Party. I mean, Peter, given what we know about your politics now, were you ever tempted to move away from Labour, join the SDP?
No, I stayed in the Labour Party. When I left university, I went to work in the economic department of the TUC. I stood for Lambeth Council, became a Lambeth councillor. I mean, I would say that all these were definitely moving me into the sort of Labour mainstream.
What do you mean by that? You were losing those kind of left-wing revolutionary roots.
I don't know, left-wing revolutionary roots. I just wanted the Labour Party to win. I didn't want the Tories to be in power. You know, I was very upset in 1979 when the Labour government was defeated. I liked Michael very much. I mean, you couldn't not like Michael Foot. I mean, he was a tremendous man. I just didn't think either he or the policies were sellable, and I didn't think we were going to win, and I hated not winning.
Well, there are certainly no crowds here at Labour Party headquarters in South East London. There seems to have been an acceptance right from the start that the Conservatives would win a resounding victory.
Steve sees Labour's 1983 defeat differently.
The SDP breakaway occurred.
I don't want to fight anybody in our own party, I repeat.
And that damaged Labour's standing in the polls.
They are reported to be flying white flags over Port Stanley.
And then, of course, you had the Falklands War, which meant that Thatcher got a bounce from what was considered the success of reclaiming the Falklands.
By 7 a.m, 4,000 miners were at Orgreave waiting for the coke lorries to arrive. Police had been expecting them.
In Sheffield, he watches bitter clashes between miners and the police.
All I know is that these bastards rushed in and this guy hit me up back at head with a bloody shield and knocked me to the ground, out.
As the decade continues, Labour becomes deeply divided.
And you end in the grotesque chaos of a Labour council, hiring taxis to scuttle round the city, handing out redundancy notices to its own workers.
Steve remains on the left, but Peter...
We've introduced a new campaigning emblem for the party.
Now Labour's Director of Communication.
An emblem which expresses the new vigour, the new confidence of the party.
Becomes pivotal in a rebranding of the party towards the centre.
Image of the Labour Party's got to be an image that's more dynamic, more modern, more suited to the 1980s.
He's particularly impressed by two up-and-coming MPs, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown.
I don't actually think it's a matter of right and left as people make it out. What I do think is that it's a matter of style.
Peter, I love this story in your book, Third Man, in which you talk about a press conference where Blair describes Thatcher as unhinged, and ITN political editor Michael Brunson pounces on the phrase as the lead for that night's News at 10.
It was a rather boring press conference about housing policy. And Tony described, you're right, Mrs. Thatcher as unhinged. And Michael Brunson rushed to the front. And I said, Michael, just calm down. I think that what Tony was saying was that there was some distance between what Mrs. Thatcher said she was trying to achieve in housing policy and what the effect of those policies actually was. He said, actually unhinged. I said, I know, but not in emotional sense.
And you convinced him?
I did.
And you realised then that you had the art of persuasion?
Well, sort of.
I mean, you went on to be called, I think, the first spin doctor in the country. And perhaps you
that
don't like
this
one so much. Prince of Darkness.
That I mean, was how in the 1990s. Obviously, I've since become the Dark Lord.
Does it bother you?
Not really, no.
Really?
He revels in it, actually. He said to me outside a PLP meeting in 2017 when the PLP were having a good old go at Jeremy.
The PLP being the Parliamentary
Labour Party. He said to me, once a spin doctor, always a spin doctor, as he went off to do some spinning with the lobby correspondents who were hanging around.
Were you still good mates at this time, in the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, we hadn't seen each other for so long.
No, I think we lost touch with each other throughout most of the 80s. We were actually put in touch with each other again in the mid-90s when Seamus Milne was writing a piece about you, and he contacted me for some background and put us in touch with each other.
Seamus Milne, Guardian columnist, now Director of Campaigns and Strategy to Jeremy Corbyn.
Very controversial, yeah.
Not at all.
Steve, in 1992, you were back in the Labour Party. You were an activist in Sheffield. I suspect you have quite a different view of what happened to what Peter says.
Yes, the winning of public opinion to support a Labour government didn't just come as a result of red roses and spinning. It's also what happens on the streets and what happens in real life. And although the miners were defeated, there was still on the ground, massive sympathy with the miners and a feeling that the miners had been badly treated. And then on top of that came later in the Thatcher era, the poll tax. And there was huge uproar about the poll tax. And I think that that did fuel support for the Labour Party and did help us get very close to winning in 92.
I mean, it's really interesting because we're going back once again to that tension that you set out at the beginning, Peter, the idea of what should the Labour Party be? Is it about people and protests, or is it about a parliamentary process and trying to get
into Parliament? I think it's also about something else. You know, in 1983, when Michael Foote was leading us in the campaign, he came back and said, my God, you know, I got so many people cheering me to the echo, great crowds of people. Well, they were Labour supporters. I remember Steve when he said, you know, Jeremy Corbyn was cheered to the echo. There were sort of crowds of people who were, you know, willing him on. Well, those are your supporters. Your supporters are your army. That's true, but they're not the people who get you over the line in winning an election.
But there's a paradox here, actually, because Peter is a great fan of Bill Clinton's. And actually, in US politics, the big rally is a way in which public opinion is won. And I've seen Bill Clinton speak
at huge university
rallies, where he's by no means preaching to the converted.
Steve, I'm not against rallies. I'm in favour of rallies because they create a sort of sense of atmosphere. But don't mistake the people who turn up and cheer you at rallies for the broad swathe of people who have votes, who are sitting at home watching the television and making up their minds whether they can trust these people and whether their policies are credible or not.
No, we obviously have to do both.
In 1994, Tony Blair becomes leader and New Labour is born.
Our party, New Labour. Our mission, New Britain. New Labour, New Britain.
And one of the big moments that outlines that shift was the decision to remove Clause 4 from the Labour Constitution, to remove the commitment to nationalisation.
Socialism, for me, was never about nationalisation or the power of the state.
I was worried at first that the party would, you know, rebel, that there would be a backlash, and that no sooner had Tony Blair been elected than he'd plunge the Labour Party into a sort of great dispute. In fact, the opposite happened.
The amendment is carried.
Well, thank you, first of all. Thank you very much indeed.
The party voted in favour of it because they knew the Labour Party had to modernise itself.
Secondly, if I can turn briefly to the name of the party, it's staying as it is.
Tony Blair said at the time, rather than be the political representatives of the working class and the trade unions, we needed to be the political arm of the British people.
Steve, can you describe how this all felt to you? And also watching your best friend from childhood,
Steve,
such
must have been
a
horrified
leading figure in it.
Well, I wasn't happy about the dropping of Clause 4, but I was keen to win the next election when it came. But I think that the Clause 4 thing goes to the heart of a fundamental underlying problem that I have with Blairism, which is this belief, essentially accepting the premise of Thatcherism, that the market is the best way to allocate resources. And so under the Labour government, 97 to 2010, you had a massive increase in outsourcing, you had a continuation of privatisation, and you had the use of PFI to fund investment in schools. And I think when you look back on that now, you've got to say that it didn't work and it's caused huge problems.
Do you remember watching Peter on the telly? Do you remember chatting to your family about how he was doing?
Yes, I was working at BBC Wales at the time as a news journalist.
I mean, you had contact here, didn't you?
Yes.
We were in touch.
And at some point, my mother had made contact. She was very active in the Labour Party in Suffolk. And I think she arranged for you to go and do a meeting for the Labour Party locally.
You'd always do it for Steve's mum.
I'd do anything for Steve's mum. I loved her.
Then in 1997, a dramatic night.
There it is, 10 o'clock, and we say Tony Blair is to be Prime Minister and a landslide is likely.
I was in Hartlepool in 1997.
How did it feel?
Shocking and exhilarating.
Joining me now are the campaign managers of the three main parties. Peter Mandelson, first of all, what's your immediate reaction to this exit poll, which gives you unbelievable scale of victory?
Well, Jonathan, you won't be surprised that I am my usual cautious self.
Did you speak to Tony Blair on the night?
Of course, yes.
What did he say?
Oh, God.
Privately to you, as opposed to on the TV.
he said, God, do you think this is for real? Do you think this is really going to happen? And then the next question was, God, who's coming into Parliament with this sort of landslide? You better do some checking.
What about you, Steve?
I was in South Wales with my family at home watching it on television, and it was very exciting. And Peter was appointed a minister without portfolio. I did get a buzz out of the fact that a school friend of mine was in the cabinet. That was a new experience for me, I have to say.
There are lots of things that happened in those early years, Peter, that people praise: the minimum wage, health and education spending, Sure Start. But one criticism from people on the left, like Steve, was creeping privatisation through PFI that they say failed. Do you accept that?
I was not the architect of PFI, but nor was it a very prominent feature of the last Labour government. And I mean,
It was used on a pretty extensive scale.
Well, set alongside everything else we did.
What were you most proud of?
Rather proud of the fact that we pursued the most coherent economic policies that enabled us to sustain economic growth right up until the financial crisis, enabled us to halve unemployment during the course of that government up until the financial crisis. The fact that we were able to lift a million pensioners and more out of poverty, the fact that we were able to reduce child poverty by over a quarter. I think these are very, very big achievements. And I just say to Steve, you know, when I hear people, even now in this leadership election, you know, talking about the last Labour government, you know, as if it was sort of continuing some sort of Thatcherite neoliberal sort of philosophy. I mean, A, I think it's ridiculous. We weren't. But secondly, let me make the point. If you spend so much time attacking your own government, you know, don't be surprised if, you know, people don't want to vote you back into power again. And I just think as a party, we've got to sort of grow up here, concentrate on persuading people to vote for us again, not confirming some in their prejudices against the last Labour government.
Well, talking of confirming people in their prejudices, I think that the most damage that was done to the reputation of the last Labour government was done by somebody leaving a note saying there is no money, and by the front bench in the period immediately after 2010 not challenging the idea that Labour had been had overspent and had left a massive pile of debt, which was the Tory attack. And I don't think we challenged austerity.
I strongly agree with that.
I don't think we challenged austerity hard enough under that particular front bench. But I don't think we should spend a lot of time attacking the record of the last Labour government. But you do need to slip into it, Steve. Yes, but you do need to analyse certain things. It was a period, you talk about economic growth, it was a period of economic growth across all the developed economies. And so therefore it was an opportunity to do things that...
So it was global conditions that produced increase in prosperity and growth and jobs and rising living standards, and that the Labour government didn't have anything to do with it.
Peter, I let you make your point.
Let me make my point
that there was an opportunity there to do more. For example, let's just take one example, the question of housing. Thatcher had stopped the building of council houses. There was a view that the private sector would step in and fill the gap. The reality of the situation was that that the private sector didn't step in and fill the gap. And when Labour was in power, house building continued at much the same level as it had been at under the Tories. If you look at the statistics, there was less council house building during that 1997 to 2010 Labour government than there had been under the Tories. And I think that was a huge opportunity missed. And I think it was missed because there was this doctrinaire view that Labour had accepted at that level that the market would solve these problems, and it doesn't work.
As it happens, I don't think it's a matter of being pro or anti-market or what our economic philosophy was. The truth is, during the Labour government, relatively speaking, both housing and transport policies were weak areas of policy formulation and implementation for that government. I accept that.
Steve, did you ever have a go at Peter? Did you ever say, think about when we were kids and when we were trying to set up a revolution in our school? Think about POTS. Think about the YCL.
Well, not at that point, if we're talking about the 1990s, but certainly after the decision on Iraq.
To retreat now, I believe, would put at hazard all that we hold dearest, Turn the United Nations back into a talking shop? Stifle the first steps of progress in the Middle East? Leave the Iraqi people to the mercy of events on which we would have relinquished all power to influence for the better? Tell our allies that at the very moment of action, at the very moment when they need our determination, that Britain faltered.
Steve mentioned Iraq. When you think of the heady days of 97 to the way that some people talk about Blairism today, do you think in terms of public perception, Iraq changed everything?
I don't think it changed everything. I wasn't in the government at the time of Iraq, famously. I'd been defenestrated by then. I did vote for it in the House of Commons, inevitably. And I reject completely the idea that it was dishonest or that we sort of went out to, you know, commit Britain to an illegal war or took Britain into a war on the basis of a lie. I think with an enormous amount of hindsight, you could describe it, yes, as a mistake, but I would say an honest mistake.
Did you two ever talk about it? Did you ever argue about it?
Well, we have argued about it.
Where?
Well, I would occasionally see Peter in the House of Commons. If I was in London, I would pop in for a cup of tea. And Peter knows how strongly I feel about it. I do think that it was based on a falsehood. I think that the agenda was essentially regime change, and we've seen how badly regime change ends. Hundreds of thousands, literally hundreds of thousands of deaths later. And I think the Labour Party has to detach itself from this idea that whatever Washington says, we go along with.
Peter, how does it feel to hear your close old friend, someone who you've said a few times you love, make that argument?
I think it's a very respectable argument. And I, you know, now know the extent to which American policy was being driven by some very hard-nosed people in the administration. And there was an extraction by those in the administration from the CIA of information, what they called intelligence, what they then turned into evidence, which turned out to be false. But you've got also to remember that all this was in the wake of 9/11, which was a completely shocking experience. There was a very great sense that we could never allow anything like that to happen again, and that we had to stand by our chief ally, the United States. But all this went on, and it was, in the end, badly conceived, badly planned, and badly executed, and it's led to the situation that we have now today.
Apologies to Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband, but we're going to fast forward the Labour story and land beyond 2015, when Jeremy Corbyn had been voted for as leader. I assume you voted for him, Steve?
I did.
I assume you didn't, Peter?
I did not.
And how was your friendship by that point?
I didn't realise that Steve was a Corbyn supporter. Honestly, when I discovered this, that he was actually going to work for him and become Seamus's deputy, I was truly gobsmacked. This was not the Steve I knew and loved.
In fact, when this happened, you had recently said to the Jewish Chronicle,
I work every single day in some small way.
That you worked every single day
to bring forward
the end of Corbyn's tenure.
The end of his tenure in office. And every day.
With an email, a phone call, a meeting with Labour MPs.
Do something to rescue the Labour Party from his leadership.
But Steve, you said Peter didn't try to dissuade you, but he did write to you and say, it pains me more than I can say that you should be making such a sacrifice, but it's your life.
I just thought this was Steve joining a team that was going to lead Labour to disaster, and it really upset me.
What was it specifically that made you feel that Corbyn was going to lead Labour to disaster? Too left-wing?
I slightly more different from that. I mean, I just feel that he sees politics as an exercise in mobilisation of the working class. And I just think he was living in the past. I mean, I just don't think he quite realises that the working class in this country has shrunk to under, you know, 50% of the electorate, and that Labour's support now, with amongst a shrunken working class has halved, if you take the recent election result, producing for Boris Johnson in the election of 2019 a 15-point lead for the Conservatives amongst working-class voters in this country. Now, something clearly went very wrong.
Well, that can be answered in one word, really, Brexit, can't it? We'll come back to that in a second, but I think what you've described there is a caricature of Jeremy Corbyn and the people who supported Jeremy Corbyn that's based on your perception of politics from the 1980s. And the groundswell of support for Jeremy Corbyn was actually coming from people who were quite new to politics, you know, mainly young people. And what we managed to do in the 2017 election, I think, is build a coalition of voters that spanned the traditional working class base, not so much in Scotland, although we did win a few more seats back in Scotland, with a younger demographic. And that's how we managed to get the best vote that Labour's had since 1997 in 2017.
But Steve, you talk about the election as if we won it. We didn't.
And Steve, let me ask you, because you wrote your book after 2017, and clearly even if Labour didn't win, it was seen as a great success to strip the Tories of their majority. We've now had 2019 and the Conservatives have a huge majority. Mm. Does that make you rethink your arguments?
Well, it's hugely disappointing that we've had that defeat, obviously. But I argued in May of last year that if Labour supported a second referendum, we would lose the election. We had a choice, I thought, at that point. We could either support a second referendum and try to reverse Brexit, or we could have a Labour government, but we couldn't have both. And sadly, that proved to be the case. But when you look at the polling on this, when people are asked, people who voted Labour in 2017 but then didn't vote Labour in 2019, a lot of people will say Brexit and a lot of people will say Jeremy Corbyn. Then when you ask the people who say Jeremy Corbyn what's changed their mind about him, they'll then say Brexit. So the views about Jeremy Corbyn and views about Brexit have become intertwined.
Stephen, I don't think people in the main had the foggiest idea what his real position was on Brexit, and I think that was the real problem.
I now understand how you both came from that very close and similar position as Labour activists in the 1960s, with a short and longer flirtation with the Young Communist League, to end up with such major roles on different wings of the Labour Party. Now faced with a new leadership election, what direction do you think Labour should take?
I think people in the Labour Party and our supporters in the country overwhelmingly want to put 2019 behind us. I think they certainly don't want a sort of Corbyn Mark II successor.
So who is that, Peter?
For him?
Who are you going to support?
I'm not absolutely sure who I'm going to support, frankly.
Emily Thornberry?
I mean, to put it mildly, none of the candidates are New Labour enough for me. So I don't know quite what I'm going to do.
Who are you going to support, Steve?
I will make up my mind on the day.
I'll be supporting Becky Long Bailey, who was the architect of our Green New Deal policy, which I think was the best part of the 2019.
And I think she has certain strengths. She has Momentum's data and she'll have Unite's money, but I think those strengths are also going to turn out to be her weaknesses.
If you can both just finally rewind yourselves to your 18-year-old selves, maybe the Peter Mandelson that was in Tanzania writing these letters, the Steve Howell who was off in America continuing to be politically active. If you could look forward and see what would happen, how do you think you would feel?
Well, if you'd have said to me in 1972, would I still be living in a society where my son works full-time in a centre for the homeless and deals day to day with the most horrendous situations that people are in, and where in this country there's well over a million families using food banks, and where inequality has increased to its highest level since the 1930s, I would be very, very disappointed to think that 50 years later we'd still be in that situation. But I hope that the seeds that have been planted in the Corbyn period in terms of more young people coming into politics and adopting progressive ideas. I'm hoping those will carry us forward and that socialism ideas will flourish in the future.
And if you want to solve the problems that you've just described, and I completely share your ambition to do so, we have to get a Labour Party that's going to win elections, and the last two we've thrown away.
Would your 18-year-old self be disappointed that society hadn't come further?
I think that many of the things, the fundamentals in politics that divided us in the 50s and the 60s and 70s, frankly, a lot of those have been resolved. You have both main parties now who accept the National Health Service, who accept free schooling. You have even conservative governments that give people workplace rights and allow trade unions to organise. Many of those ideological divides, those fundamental divides, have actually been resolved in favour of the left. The centre-left, the social democrats in this country, have won. We have prevailed. We have now got to take on new challenges, which are just as pressing. They're not quite as ideological, but they are just as big. And that's what we've got to focus on looking forwards.
And does your Labour Party span wide enough to include Steve?
Of course it does. Of course it does.
Thank you, Peter.
And despite everything that has happened to both of you politically, are you still as close as you once were?
Well, we're a dance like closer as a result of this podcast. I mean, emotionally and through our memories and our shared experiences than we were before we came into the studio.
Well, that's very nice. Steve?
I'll concur with that.
Well, on that warm note, I'm going to say thank you, Steve. Thank you, Peter.
Pleasure.
That was Peter Mandelson and Steve Howell, who have both written books about aspects of their very different political journeys. If you're interested in the debate raging within the Labour Party, then come to Manchester on February the 25th for our leadership hustings with Keir Starmer, Rebecca Long-Bailey, Lisa Nandy and Emily Thornberry, or whichever of them are left in the contest. I'm hosting it and would love to throw in some questions from our Today in Focus listeners. Go to membership.theguardian.com. Coming up, how to handle climate anxiety. Now, we've had a year marked by severe warnings about the real and potential impact of the climate emergency facing the Earth. On a hopeful note, that has led to a global uprising. But how does this existential threat to the way we live our lives affect people's mental health? Here's The Guardian's environment correspondent Matthew Taylor on the rise of climate anxiety.
Over the past 12 months, we've been bombarded by pre-apocalyptic news around the environment, from melting ice caps in the Antarctic, from what's happening in the Amazon, to wildfires, to flooding. And I think it's increasingly difficult, stroke impossible, to ignore the sort of scale and severity of the crisis. But as well as the physical impact of these events, I think people are waking up to the toll it's taking on people's mental well-being. And that is what we're really talking about when we're talking about climate anxiety. Climate anxiety is two separate things. The climate anxiety about fear of what's coming and the climate trauma about actually having lived through some of those events, as many people in the global south have been doing for quite a long time. And of course, in the UK, we've had pretty severe flooding, and there is some research to show the psychological impact of that on people who've lived through that. They're more likely to be depressed, they're more likely to have ongoing anxiety problems. These things do take their toll on people's mental well-being as well as their physical housing and economic situations. For climate anxiety, first of all, I'm not a psychologist, but this is my understanding of how you might sort of spot somebody with climate anxiety or be suffering from it yourself. It's a sort of long-term anxiousness. It's often a feeling of isolation. And it's often said that there is a comparison to the fear around nuclear war of the 70s and 80s. The psychologist I was talking to described it as a professional paralysis amongst researchers and scientists working in the field who had just felt they were overwhelmed by what they were facing and didn't feel that they were able to actively do anything. Climate anxiety is a real issue for lots of people, particularly young people. And I think part of the issue is that we live in a sort of consumer society, for want of a better phrase, and we're all treated as individual consumers. And I think there's a lot of pressure on us to think of this as our individual problem. So it's about which coffee cup we use, how many flights we take, what our food is wrapped in. And so that's a real weight on people to think this is my fault. I need to change my lifestyle. And there is obviously some merit in that, in our personal choices. But I think that takes a huge toll on people's mental well-being. One of the psychologists I was speaking to said the penny really dropped for him and his team, who had now dedicated themselves to this issue, was when they realised that the cure for climate anxiety was the same as a cure for the wider crisis. It's about coming together, supporting each other and demanding real, meaningful, urgent, radical change and not feeling like this is all on you as an individual. For parents and teachers, that's what you're trying to get to come together and take small steps to address some of these issues, even if they're small scales, but recognise the successes you've had collectively as a family or as a class. I think it's okay to acknowledge that this is a crisis and then to talk about that. And I think for parents particularly, it's okay not to know the answers to all the questions. There's places out there that you can go and find out. This isn't all on people as individuals. It can't be. We need systemic change and we need politicians and others in power to recognise that and start acting.
That was Matthew Taylor, who has written about this over the weekend. Check out his article at theguardian.com. That's all for today. Many thanks to Peter Mandelson, Steve Howell and Matthew Taylor. This episode was produced by Rose Della Rabiti, Courtney Youssef and Gregory Robinson. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.